Welcome to Online Gods, a podcast about digital cultures in India and beyond. Today we're talking about religious nationalism with Peter van der Veer and political comics with ApuPen. I'm your host, Ian Cook. Are we allowed to make fun of God, of other people's gods? How about our leaders or other people's leaders? I think it's fair to say that the rather daft idea that scientific rationalism would secularise the world has been proven to be wrong. So maybe we need to get more creative with how we think about changes in the public sphere that have been going on with modernisation over the last century or so. Maybe there's been a mediatisation of the public sphere. Or especially thinking about the way interactions go online, a humorization of the public sphere, a humorization of religious discourse. Or maybe I should just stop putting "ization" on the end of words and pretending it's somehow some conceptual innovation and just get on with the podcast where we get to speak to a couple of people who really know their stuff about these topics. And so this month, like all months, we're going to speak first to an academic expert on a certain topic or concept, and then an online god, someone who is using new media in an innovative or influential way. And this month, first of all, we're speaking with Peter van der Veer about, among other things, religious nationalism, and then with ApuPen about political cartoons. This is a partner podcast of the American Anthropological Association, and it's part of a bigger project on digital dignity led out of LMU Munich by Sahana Udupe. And like last month, Sahana is up first, speaking with our first guest, Peter van der Veer. Peter is a director at the Max Planck Institute for the Study of Religious and Ethnic Diversity. He has had a long and very illustrious career working mostly on religion and nationalism in Asia and Europe. I'll put a link to most of his relevant work on the website. I hope you enjoy the interview.
Thank you very much, Peter, for coming on the podcast. My first question is about the concept of secularism and the way you have critiqued the Western liberal ideas of secularism based on your extensive work on Hindu nationalism in India. Recent studies have emphasized that the liberal dream of relegating religion to the private domain has not just come true. On the one hand, there are arguments about desecularization of society. On the other hand, studies have contended that this desecularization thesis depends on assumptions of linear modernization, sometimes even reproducing the civilizational arguments, keeping post-Enlightenment's transition as the primary reference point. There is religion everywhere today, as political formations, as doctrines of statecraft, as cultural programs. From the colonial and post-colonial context that you have closely studied, how do you understand the so-called crisis of secularism and the nature of public expressions of religion?
Well, I think for me, one thing was important is my own upbringing in a modern Dutch society, which was not secularized at all in the 1950s. Dutch society was entirely organized around so-called religious pillars. The Protestants, the Catholics, and people would only marry with each other, so it would be endogamous systems, and the political system was entirely dependent on the social divisions. So I've never quite understood what people meant with the secularization thesis. I do see enormous differences. First of all, between the United States and Europe, and that was the Western world was actually the basis for the secularization thesis. Nobody who works on Indonesia, India, would be interested in the secularization thesis because it's so obviously not working there. So secularization as a term and a concept is interesting to look at in terms of Christian churches and so on, in Europe and America, so churching and de-churching and so on. But they are very, very variable. And in the Netherlands, which is a modern industrial and a rich society, basically secularization only happened in the 1960s as part of the youth revolution and the sexual revolution. So it's a very different kind of secularization than often was argued for in secularization theory, which was mostly about modernization and industrialization and so on. So when you go then to India, which I did, to study India, I've never really very much looked at secularization. But secularism was definitely available in terms of the constitution and in terms of especially Nehruvian ideas of how India should be. And that was basically an India that should be more or less the same as the British had left it. But now with Indians in power. So of course it was nationalist. Of course it was the nationalist movement who got rid of the Brits. But they wanted to take over most of the institutions of the secular state. And the secular state in India, also therefore quite specific, there's a very specific historical pathway, is therefore a inheritance from the colonial period. And in the colonial period, it meant basically neutrality. So you leave people arranging their stuff on their own. So you have different kind of codes, religious codes, civil codes, for dealing with marriage and divorce and the whole inheritance and so on. And you leave the Muslims on their own, and you leave the so-called Hindus on their own. That was a neutral policy that the British developed after the mutiny. And that was taken over by the Congress government. That secularism in India was then called pseudo-secularism by their opponents, the Jansang and then later the BJP. These people argued that this secularism was just a electoral strategy, using voting banks and trying to pamper, as they say, the minorities for electoral gain. Now, this is not entirely untrue. But definitely there was more to it, and certainly in institutional sense, so the constitutions and the legal arrangements of India have a strong secular nature. Electoral politics can never be entirely secular, because if religion is a major factor in social life, which it is, then you use it to mobilize people for electoral purposes, which has always been done, also by the Congress. I mean, there's nothing in that sense, no difference between the Congress and the BJP. Only the BJP goes further and also is more explicit about it. But the Congress also had always to deal with religious factors and in its electoral politics. So you have to make a division between what happens in political life. So elections and political power, and what happens in the institutions. And one always hopes that the institutions are robust enough to be a bulwark against radical or aggressive forms of religious mobilization. But religious mobilization happened all the time. So I worked in India in the late 70s and beginning of the 80s, caste and religion were the political issues in Uttar Pradesh where I was. And just before elections, you would always have riots. So riots were part of the system of elections. Now it seems that the riots are not any more necessary, because the BJP has made so-called Hinduism or Hindutva into a commonsensical basis of being Indian. And which, of course, does away with the enormous diversity of Hinduism. But in fact, you know, in fact, you should, if they are powerful enough, you should not need any violence anymore. Although they actually do still incite violence. But I think there is also, of course, a more complex dynamic between different factions of the BJP. But I think the ideologues basically have made it into something almost commonsensical. To be Hindu, to be an Indian is to be a Hindu.
Absolutely. So let's just expand this a bit beyond the Indian scenario. So the other crucial dynamic that comes up in your discussion is nationalism, right? The discourse of modernity that opposed the religious to the secular led us to believe that nationalism as feelings of collective belonging have little to do with religion. And you also mentioned that. But your major contribution has been to emphatically challenge this assumption. You have argued that theories of nationalism should not ignore the importance of colonialism and Orientalism in the spread of nationalism. From your anthropological historical work on religious nationalism in India, Hindutva in particular, how do you see the relevance of this argument in the current times of revived belligerent xenophobic nationalisms in Europe and North America, as well as in India and China?
Yeah, I see nationalism as a inescapable political reality in the entire world. So it's an ideology about, say, the political agency of the people. Its major question is always who belongs to the people and who doesn't. And these divisions you can make on basis of region, so locale, you can make geographical, you can say Assam belongs or doesn't belong, or Kashmir belongs or doesn't belong. This is everywhere. I just use India as my example. You can do language. Language politics was always very, so people who don't speak Kannada, they don't really belong to the mainstream. It's actually should all be national language, Hindi. We have had that too, of course, in India. And then religion is another potential identifier which can be used for national mobilization. Now, in India, that has been done from the start of nationalism. It has been really very much at the roots of Indian nationalism. And even the people who, like Nehru and so on, who are seen as secularists, basically see Hindu civilization as the basis of being Indian. And the mobilization of the Congress Party also always went through religious symbolism and so on. Gandhi was, of course, the best example of that. So in India, religion is simply a very big reality. And it is constantly used for nationalist mobilization. The trick is, of course, to create a national majority on the basis of being a Hindu. Now, being a Hindu, yeah, you are yourself, I guess, a Hindu. This is actually a very difficult signifier because basically you have no idea what it actually means. Because it means so many things in India. It's incredibly pluralistic. It's in that sense also incredibly beautiful because it has such an enormous range of expressions that it is very hard to say, well, we make that into a common basis of our nation. But that is, of course, what Savarkar and everyone else has tried to do, and which they seem to be more successful in now, in creating this Hindutva. Now, there's not that much. I mean, there are family resemblances between, say, practices in UP and practices in, Andhra Pradesh. But they are family resemblances. There are very different kinds of traditions in which people stand. And sometimes they cannot understand each other. Well, they cannot, when they speak their own language, they cannot understand each other. But culturally, they also sometimes cannot understand each other. So to make this all into one pot and say, well, this is the basis of our nation, is a huge trick. And therefore, you need the other. You need the Muslims, you need the Christians. But basically, in India, in the Indian context, you need the Muslims to be, well, we are not Muslim. And we are all unified in seeing the Muslim as a danger, and we are all unified in seeing Muslim rule in the past as a humiliation of the Hindu nation and so on. So you basically mobilize, as usual, in a xenophobic way. Now, this is obviously what the Europeans are masters in also. They can do that also endlessly. Either you do the Jews, which was a not only in Germany, this was all over the place. Germany did it more bureaucratically efficient and then became a big killing machine. But the rest was also anti-Semitic. So you use the Jews, an international conspiracy of money, like George Soros. Are you in the current context, which is the context from the 1960s onwards, you use the Muslims again? And so basically many of the discussions and ways of thinking about Muslims in Europe resemble those earlier ideas about Jews. So if you can use religion for nationalist mobilization, then you will do it. And this is not only here, not only in India, it's also Indonesia, it's in Thailand, it's basically everywhere. So to me, there's nothing new in this. Of course, the forms that it takes has to be understood in terms of the history of a country. And so you have cow protection movements in India, protecting the mother cow already in the 1920s. And now you get these activists who want to kill Muslim butchers and so on. So there's a continuity there. But there are also big changes.
So what are the changes? So when you talk about changes, I think the first question is about media. Mm-hmm. Right? What are the mediated forms? Mm-hmm. And from the vast number of studies that you have led mm-hmm. or mentored, mm-hmm. how do you understand the relationship between internet-enabled media mm-hmm. and religious expressions and mm-hmm. religious politics?
Yeah, well, the one thing you immediately had to deal with in my early studies on Ayodhya and on the Ramayana and so on, was television. So the televised Ramayana was a big deal and was of course a unifier and of course changed people's relationship to Ram and Sita, to the main protagonist. From there it has only developed into a huge media world, which is very hard to grasp. And I'm not an expert on it. You are much more an expert on it than I am. But there is no doubt that slowly with telecommunication, people have become connected over large expanses. In the past, when I was doing my research, I had to book a trunk call. It would take 2 hours to even call from Faizabad to Lucknow. Now, everyone has a mobile. And that mobile can also do other kinds of things. It can send messages. I'm on Facebook with people who live in temples in India. So what I want to say is that the acceleration of connections and the intensification of it, and therefore also the possibilities to manipulate it, have grown enormously if you compare the earlier forms of rumor. So you spread a rumor saying Hindu girl captured by Muslim boy. Now, you can also get a lot of local riot about it. But now you basically accuse Muslims of all kinds of stuff, or your political opponents of all kinds of stuff. You spread fake news, as they say. And that has much more traction over much wider areas. So I think that has, of course, changed the whole mental way in which people look at things. And I think there's also an element in it that the middle class sees itself as a global middle class. They may like Indian food, they may like Indian music, but basically they see themselves as entirely part of a global middle class. Now, that can only happen when you are connected to the rest of the world. And that has happened. And basically the Congress Party has started with it, and then that it has been very rapidly taken over by the BJP. And so I don't think it is different in essence from what happened elsewhere. But India is always different because it is so huge, and there are so many potential ways of aligning people together. And V.S. Naipaul, you may not like him, but he has a good phrase: a million mutinies. Well, if you connect a million mutinies with the new communication possibilities, yeah. And then you have a huge mutiny. So that happened in India, I think.
Okay. When you talk about the complexity, just in India, I'm really encouraged to ask another question about the range of complexity that we as anthropologists try to understand and put together in our work. So that brings me to the question on the value of comparison in anthropology. In our study on online extreme speech, for instance, we are trying to see how best to develop a critical comparative framework that's rooted in ethnographic sensibility. But comparative anthropology is not easy. You talked about the complexity just within India. So the minutiae of details and the study of the particular that an anthropologist is so closely attached to have to somehow, they should be linked to broader categories for comparison, right? So your latest book, The Value of Comparison, published by the Duke University Press, takes up this challenge head on. What then is the value of comparison? What value does anthropological comparison bring to social theory? And what is the point of departure here? Because comparison is also something that other social sciences practice.
Well, basically, any researcher gets totally absorbed by her topic of study, right? That's what happens, and it can also not be otherwise. And then you also understand your topic of study on the basis of the literature that has to do with that topic, and that is mostly from your regional expertise. So people bring regional expertise, they build up regional expertise, and they understand the phenomenon that they see very much in relation to the older literature and to the new phenomena. They don't have time, and mostly also not really the inclination, to see whether these things are very specific for India or for any other country. So one thing which I think needs to happen is that one has to look at other places where similar phenomena are happening, and to see what is the unicity of your own, the distinctive elements of your own topic of research. And then you may actually also ask other questions, because questions that are asked in China are often not the same questions that are asked in India. So when you look at research in China, you raise a number of possibilities and questions. So why didn't that happen in India? So you look at the Indian case again from that comparative experience. The implicit comparison was always with the West, so Euro-America. And I think that is really passé. We should actually move quickly beyond that and look very much more at as Asia, but also Asia and Africa, to look at comparative elements and things that you want to understand comparatively with a vocabulary that is much more derived from those cases. We cannot go on with having a 19th century European social science dealing with a incredibly and fastly changing world in, especially because I work on Asia, especially in Asia. And I think it is also accelerated in Asia. And it's vastly accelerated in China, where I have now done quite a bit of work. It is about time to have a new concepts that are dealing with that new reality, and it cannot be entirely derived from 19th century social science. That is, I think, simply the case. It's not so easy because a lot of institutions and so on, a lot of social reality, is indeed still based on the colonial 19th century experience. But in so many ways, in industry and communications and so on, we have moved so far beyond that that it's not anymore useful. I don't anymore know what a person is, what the individual is. All the discussion that we have had in the anthropology, what is the, say, the Hindu individual and so on, from ideologies of caste exchange, etc. I mean, look at the world in which Indians live today. You cannot deal with that from a kind of conceptualized rural India. Rural India is already a very different place than it was 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. So comparatively, I would say, derive questions from other Asian and African or Latin American experiences to ask other questions about India. And otherwise also for those people to use India as a comparative case. And then try to develop conceptual frameworks that are much more in tune with what happens today.
Thank you very much. My last question that we ask all our guests is the idea of digital dignity. Hmm. And we have coined this term to emphasize the need to promote online spaces as enabling and empowering spaces for political expression. How do you understand digital dignity? Would you have any thoughts on digital dignity as an idea?
No, I think dignity in itself is a very important concept. It's very underestimated. When you take people's dignity away, you take more away, almost you take their life away, their life as a respectable person. So that's why the things that happen with Muslims in India are really very troublesome, because they take the dignity of people away. And that similar things in Europe. Digital dignity is then a special case of that. And the internet is, of course, not a very dignified space. First of all, I think, I don't know what the percentage is of porn on internet, but it must be substantial. And there's also a very substantial part of hate exchanges, and so it is, you could say, it is not a civilized space. And people also nowadays, I think that is true, although I don't have the evidence, but I think people become much more emotionally involved in all kinds of issues they have nothing to do with through the internet. So everyone has an opinion about everything now, and then also heated. Reading a book is always a slower process and therefore more dignified, I think, than much of these internet exchanges. I'm just troubled by the way this has become a free space for emotional outbursts in which people allow themselves all kinds of stuff. And it raises the question of the dignity of our society. And It's a troubling question. It's a question that one has to raise always in relation to your own. What do you think is your own dignity? Where is it threatened? And how can I respect the dignity of someone else? It's a basic humanistic question.
Thank you very much, Peter. Thank you for your time and all your wonderful insights. Thank you.
Thank you.
What I thought was one of the important takeaways from that discussion was how the portrait or creation of the other is vital for religious nationalism in different contexts. If you look at the comics created by our next guest, Apu Pen, then you'll see how he plays on this by highlighting the absurdity of some of this othering of minorities by creating a nationalistic superhero called Rashtraman. Now, Rashtraman fights for the nation, for corporate power and religion. And he does this by doing such things as saving flags from the rain and using cow dung balls to defeat evil villains such as Equality and Liberty. This is one of these things where crossing mediums even makes it sound completely ridiculous or not funny, or maybe even funnier. So maybe check out the comics themselves to see how it plays out in the medium it was created for. Now, Apupen usually tells stories from a mythical dimension called Hala Hala, and he's produced four graphic novels set in this world, the latest of which is called The Snake and the Lotus, which is about, well, AI machines, basically. Anyway, but today we're going to be speaking with him mostly about his online comics, especially the aforementioned Rashtraman, and also get his views on how the internet is basically enabling certain discourses through the medium of comic or graphic art, or how it's basically constraining it. Anyway, let's hear from him now. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Apupen to Online Gods. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Ian. Nice. Online gods. Yes.
Everyone should be a god at some point in their life, right? So you're a comics creator, a visual artist, and also a musician. And you're probably best known for your work set in Hala Hala, which is a mythical place which is quite dark, twisted, and yet fun. At least that's how I first came across your work. But today I want to talk to you about a couple of your other creations. One is Dystopian Times, and another is Rashtraman. So maybe let's start with him. Okay. Who is or what is Rashtraman?
Oh, okay. To give you a context to it, I've been trying to build this world of Hala Hala, and it's a kind of parallel, and it morphs and it changes to suit the story, and that's where I think of it as a fantasy world. It's not a world with a dragon hiding behind a mountain and things like that. So in this world, I've made 3-4 graphic novels from that. And in our market here, or in the scene out here, I find that the graphic novels are a very elite form of putting out your work. Rashtraman is my answer to superheroes, because at some point I did contemplate whether, I have a superhero in me. And I really hate the idea. I hate it from different angles. I don't like the idea of putting up somebody as a god, like online gods. we have enough gods over here. You turn around anywhere, there's a different god or a statue or, so this projecting a person as a super being is also problematic in our culture. So Rashtraman is sort of my open answer to all these things. So it's like, it's how a Captain America would dress up in the flag and, probably stand for a lot of history, war, all the stuff that probably the powers would want to make okay, or make it seem like it's part of everyday living. And also brands, big brands, like these guys become ambassadors for like big brands. So that whole indie idea of comics, like what I liked about comics, it sort of vanished when it came to all these things, So the idea of a superhero becomes sort of like that. And Rashtraman is brazenly standing for this very right-wing approach, a lot of control, totalitarian sort of running of a country. And the country is called Rashtriya. Rashtriya, Rashtra means country generally, and our president is the Rashtrapati. So Rashtriya is like a take on Rashtra as such. And that's the country he comes from. Therefore, he's Rashtraman. And the main city is Rashtropolis. So taking on all these general comic tropes that we have. he's aggressive. He is the business corporate end of things. He's a marriage between the state and business, big business. So he's all that put into one, you know. And that's the only way I could possibly work on a superhero, you know. That's the only way I could address a superhero or make one of my own. So that's where he came from. And I think I started putting it out in 2015. It was basically a new thing for me to do because the politics that I was reading about and was happening around me was very different all of a sudden. After 2014, it was suddenly seeming very different. I felt it sort of attacked my space, or me being an artist and that freedom of thought when you want to like think of or explore more areas. I think it was directly like threatening that space, and that's what got me thinking about like how do I want to address this as an artist, as a comic creator. Like, you know, there's something I want to say about this. That's how the whole thing came together.
I want to I want to go on to talk in a short while about sort of the choice of like single image or multi-panel comics, and also about the politics. But before we do that, could you just talk a little bit also about Dystopian Times, which is probably your other directly political work? This is basically a play on a newspaper, but could you just tell us a little bit about this?
I was thinking of it as in a newspaper sort of newspaper cartoon sort of format. That's what I want to do. It's also a risky kind of space, and I've stayed away from it a little bit because, you know, nowadays there are trends, and the trends are kind of manufactured, and newspaper cartoonists, because they go every day at it, they sometimes get caught in these trends and forget the larger picture completely. So there is some the joke about the tallest statue in the world or something like that, and then the whole media and all the cartoonists go after that for like 2 days, and then, you know, we forget about it, and then we have the next bigger statue coming somewhere else or some other topic somewhere else. So it seems like it gets you in a sort of a wheel, you know, and you won't realize it. So I didn't want to go to an everyday kind of thing, but try and remove myself from what I'm hearing once in a while and create an image that may make sense without the context of that particular day's news also. That was a bit of the challenge. Also, I am, in terms of newspaper and general media, I think we have some very, like, funny bad newspaper giants around who, as in terms of you know, as far as media goes, I really don't think they've done the job. They've swallowed the diktat and they've kept to it. Even now, if I want to publish any of my comics, I can't even go to a lot of the people because there are diktats saying that they cannot print anything that is critical of the government or certain parties like that. And, you know, these editors and these newspapers, they follow it because the advertising lot and the corporate lobby is also going with this thing. So I think there are very few places. It's very clear. Like, if you online, you can see The Wire or a few places like that. Caravan does some great work. But generally, what we consider the mainstream media has really let us down, is what I think. Not just because I can't get my comics printed there, but generally on a larger, plane, like, I think so. I've faced it a lot of times. Even my interviews get censored and the important points get left out. Yeah, so, you know, the Times of India was like a prime example of how you sell media space. And, you know, even if I have money, I can get lead articles about Halahala there. You know, just like how builders are getting articles about their property and saying this part of the city is going to be booming and things like that. So once I got the Times as the name, then it, you know, I can really play with that. So it was just a question of like what Times, you know, and then, yes, Dystopian Times gives it that ring that I want to have it. And the first few comics were already there. I'd made some. There was this black and white, very old newspaper style it was in the beginning. There's this ship coming, there's a large ship coming, and it says, I think it says, INS dictatorship. It's like Indian naval ship, dictatorship. And on the other side, these guys are sinking, and there's a cow also sinking. And they're like, help, you know, we're sinking. And then, oh yeah, we're saved. There's a ship. So just climb on to this ship to like save your life. And it happens to be the dictatorship. And then I've been trying to address these larger trends in the way things are changing from a slightly zoomed out perspective most of the time.
It's good. I want to talk a little bit about, I suppose, about the about a question of form, I suppose, like and the medium and possibilities for creativity, about how you design things specifically for online uh-huh. consumption. I know because as you mentioned before, and I also mentioned you've also made graphic novels as well. And I think there's a feeling, and maybe somebody made this argument more eloquently than I'm about to put it now to you, but I somehow feel that right now, like the single image plus text, whether it's a meme or a cartoon or whatever, seems to be the most sort of the quintessential form of sort of online media consumption. I was thinking if we go back to maybe like, you know, 1970s or 80s, when we remember those really striking images from the time, political images. I'm thinking, you know, for instance, of the girl running away from American bombs in Vietnam. Yeah. Or somebody says it was just an image, but now it seems to be image plus text. And I'm wondering, like, if you agree with my sort of wild hypothesis right now, and if so, like, why do you think it's so? Why do you think image plus text has become such a way of communicating ideas these days?
Yeah, it's pretty sad when you talk about that. Overall, yes, we know that people can't stay and read just text. If you look at ads also, from the ads are always, advertisements is always a very good indicator, because, you know, those guys have done their market research and they know what sells. That's why they do things a certain way. So there is always some information we can always tap from the way they are doing their trends. So if you see an ad in a magazine or something from the 70s or 80s, there's a whole pile of text. They expect you to go through the whole story to drink, you know, some Campa Cola or some orange drink or something like that. That you can see, like, over time, by the time you know, I was in advertising in 2000 2001, it was pretty much compressed to one big line and maybe one or two lines explaining it if needed, and the logo and the product are taking maximum space. So if you look at it in terms of comics, personally I prefer silent comics. I'm working on a whole bunch of silent stuff now. I feel that, I don't know, I managed to get to another level with the work, I feel, with that. Reason is also that the silent comics require the reader's input. So we create a few guides, we create the ambience, and we let the reader go through that. Wander through that space, and we just provide the guide so that he doesn't fall off the story track, and then we lead him to the next panel like that. So it requires the involvement from there, and in some ways I think it, you know, I consider music without lyrics, like I trip on it more. I think there is another level you can reach when it's just instrumental and it's really nice stuff. I feel that language, when it comes in, you know, it comes in with a lot of baggage. It comes in with a lot of rules. So I think if we can pure, it's a lot more, open and pure in some way, if I can lead them without the text. But here we have people who want that instant, I won't say gratification as such, that instant realization, or they don't want to be in doubt. Being in doubt or being asked to like go into a new territory disturbs them. And if they disturb it, like, you know, it's at your fingertips. You can just like close the window or like swipe or like go to the next one. It's not for you. So we are not even allowed to give that. Use that element of disturbance. Like, you know, a lot of the art and the comics I do rely on the thing that, you know, we disturb the comfort bubble that the reader is in. That's how we try to make a point. We disturb it through humor. We disturb it through art. It's satire. So if he laughs along, then there is a better chance that he might agree with our point of view, that, you know, he's laughing with it. So at least he got the joke. So he's softer to accept this point of view. But here, it's getting a lot more tighter. And, you know, in that one visual and that one line, often the line is riding on some other trend or some popular meme or some, you know, some movie or something like that also. So the discourse and what you're interested in has become very narrow. So you have to hit within that area to make a connect. So the line is also very tricky that way. If you can just, like, you know, get their attention and make them feel that, yes, they got it. That's why the line is so important with the image, because the image alone leaves it to the audience to make that final call. And I would definitely like to give that to the audience, or, you know, I would hate to read something that treats me like an idiot. You know, like, give me some sort of, like, respect for, like, you know, or at least some faith that I can follow the thought.
I think I agree with quite a lot of what you say, because I was thinking, so you have this, maybe you have more than one, I apologize if so, but your one silent comic or wordless comic that I know, which is Legends of Hala Hala, am I right?
Yeah.
And like that one, I remember I was reading that much slower than I would usually read a comic. Because sometimes I have this tendency, I guess, like a lot of people do, just to read the words because of the story and skip a lot of the images sometimes, especially when the story is quite exciting. And I somehow have to force myself, wait, I need to pay attention as well. But with that, when, I mean, it's quite a thin, quite a slim volume, but I read it over really quite a long period of time, because I was reading each panel quite slowly to make sure I could work out what's the story, like, where's it going and stuff like this. So I think there's definitely a speed difference when there's words. Okay, Let's return to the focus ourselves on the online world, and I want to ask you as my final question, a question we ask everybody who comes on the podcast, because this podcast this podcast is a part of a wider research project into what we're calling digital dignity. We're wondering, is there a possibility to have dignified debate about politics, religion, national belonging online today? So I was wondering, what do you think, is the online space a space for digital dignity?
I don't know. It's a tricky thing. It's a lot like the free market, maybe. You know, so in that sense, when even I believed that when I was introduced to the online space and I could get a website and everything, it seemed very clear. Oh, you can put up your space, you know, you can put up your work, you get a little space, and then it's an equal platform. That's the way it felt like. And now you see, like, how it can be used and manipulated, and now it's all about the game of manipulating the space. And now when it spreads to you know, harvesting data and creating profiles individually for people, you know, sort of curating content and things like that, I'm not so sure. I by nature, I'm not a very technology friendly person. I try to, like, cut it down as much, but it's the only way I can put out the work now, so it's helping me. To be fair, I put up a website in 2006-2007, and I was emailing friends to check it out, and that's how I found my publisher. My publisher saw my stuff online and then asked me if I wanted to publish work. So it personally, it has been good to me. But as a space now, with the kind of awareness and the kind of forces working with it now, we've stopped trusting most of the stuff we read online and in newspapers most of the time. So I don't think it's just about the online space. I think it's really difficult to get a meaningful trustworthy space to discuss anything in these. I wouldn't still really be comfortable unless it's a face-to-face like discussion with somebody. If it's a larger group, then I'm always not sure. And when it goes online, you've seen how it sort of spirals out immediately. I don't know. Is this what you mean?
Yes, yes. I was wondering, like, I mean, like, exactly, like when you put work out there, right? It's what happens to that? Can you see discussions that take place around your work? Is that is it something there you feel like there's possibility there for, I don't know, genuine discourse around the topic? Or
We haven't found it as yet. Like I said, I feel good that, you know, people share it or connect with that kind of idea. So that part is nice. But whenever it becomes a discussion or whenever discussions have erupted on our pages, it's always a paid interest or a troll or somebody who's coming and just abusing people or just being, you know, loud about it. Yesterday, I had put up a post saying, you know, there was a Comic-Con happening here. So there's a friend and my old publishing house, they have two stalls there. So I put up a post which says Rashtraman Comics are available at the Blaft stall and with Rahil Mohsin at stall number E13 or something like that. And right under that, there's a comment. Somebody's come and he's put something saying, have you noticed all these efforts always are done by these goddamn hajis? Goddamn hajis. It's not really even like... So this is a new breed of trolls who speak like a more westernized language, and they come in packs now. So there's immediately one guy who likes the comment and comes under that and says, true that. And there's a 100% icon, you know. And I'm trying to see where is this Haji thing coming from. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, you know, I've mentioned this fellow's name, that his stall, it's available at... that's all. So, you know, if you want to get involved in that conversation, or you want to say or point out that, you know, that's not really, I don't know, like, where do you start with something like that? Otherwise, where there is a conversation happening and you're discussing things, there is so much of fake data and fake news. So people will pull from there, and overall it becomes a very confusing space. And I think that is the game. Like online, it's difficult because there is not even just online, but there is always this concerted effort to confuse people, to float around like too much information that nobody can really focus on anything. Even climate change, half the people are not even ready to say it's there. So how did that happen? Like, that effort is a very corporate kind of effort. It's a manipulation. It's like advertising, but it's quite like how Rashtraman would advertise himself. It's very open. It's very like, you know, it's very straightforward. There's no. We had to spend time in advertising to see how carefully we are placing the weakness of the product as its strength. You know, we had to be very crafty about it. But now there is no, you don't have to be. You can just straight away like put all kinds of information. And I think that is what is happening in the world politics also, confusing everybody so that nobody can predict how you're going about things or what you're doing. And the more mysterious you are, I don't know. It seems to be the thing. So not very faithful about the space. I would use it to a certain extent, but I would be very careful about how much I depend on it also. I don't know where it's going. So I wouldn't put all my eggs in this basket. Maybe there are no other baskets left after this, but still not sure.
So maybe a slightly bleak picture. Maybe Rashtraman can come and save us all in the end, if we're lucky. Apupen, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been really great having you on Online Gods.
Hey, thank you very much, Ian.
I think Apupen was onto something really interesting when he spoke about how, now more than ever, people seem to want to have the message of everything made more explicit, that less and less content creators want people to interpret their works in different or ambiguous ways. And it's interesting, I think, that this has gone hand in hand with a sort of masses and massive of information, which is now put out there in the online public sphere. And this, he, Apu Pen, and also many others claim, is somehow done deliberately to obscure the facts, to obscure what's really going on, to create confusion. It's another thing, like I say very often in this podcast, that I think we should keep looking into in the months ahead. All right, that is it from us this month. I hope you've enjoyed listening to the podcast. You can get in touch on Twitter at Online Gods, or you can check us on the website for digitaldignity.com, or you can get us on Facebook for Digital Dignity, or email onlinegodspodcast@gmail.com. It's always nice to know what you're thinking about what we're doing. Hope you enjoyed the podcast. Bye. Thank you so much for listening to the Online Gods podcast. Online Gods is part of the project Online ARPOL, funded by the European Research Council, starting grant agreement number 714285. The project's PI is Sahana Udapa, who's Professor of Media Anthropology at the Department of Social and Cultural Anthropology, Ludwig Maximilian University, Munich, Germany. I've been your host, Ian Cook. Goodbye.